the sort of message I'd been giving him every day in person. Did I believe it? I wasn't sure, but it felt good to write. I added another line in the same crimped handwriting. Flush this down the toilet as soon as you read it. I tore the page from the notebook and ripped away the blank edges until it was a tiny scrap containing only the writing. I rolled what was left into a compact white pellet about the size of a pencil eraser, and then, before I could talk myself out of it, I knocked on the door for permission to use the bathroom. The boys had grown too lazy to escort us to and from the toilet as they had in the early weeks in previous houses. When one of us knocked on the metal door, the guard on duty, usually sitting out on the veranda, would quickly lean over and glance in our direction and then snap his fingers a few times loudly to indicate that we had permission. The hallway running through the house was L-shaped, with my room located at the junction. A guard sitting on the veranda might have a view of my doorway, but would not be able to see around the corner to the rest of the hall, the stubby part of the L, which led to Nigel's new room and beyond, the bathroom. When the snap came, I stood, holding the balled-up note loosely in my palm, and started down the hall. Whatever soldier was on duty, whoever had snapped his fingers, was nowhere in sight. The hallway was about 15 feet long, with thick blue walls and a white-tiled floor. Nigel's room was on the right, next to mine. Passing by his open door, I took a fast look out the corner of my eye to make sure he was alone, and then, with a flick of the wrist, I sent my little note sailing. As the ball of paper skittered across the floor, I caught a sideways glimpse of Nigel lying on his mattress, face up, possibly asleep. I continued on to the bathroom, my heart racing, hoping like hell he'd find it before any of the boys did. It had occurred to me that, due to the way our two rooms were positioned, he had no ability to respond. There was no circumstance under which Nigel would have to pass by my door. Our communications could only be one way. Back in my room, I stewed over our new reality. I imagined Nigel on the other side of the wall, lost in his own worries, though I knew instinctively that I was now the more vulnerable one. The wall was green and veined with cracks in the plaster. I guessed it was probably about 12 inches thick. As an experiment, I tried rapping a knuckle against it. The sound was slow, not seeming to travel far, caught in the wall's density. A moment passed. I sat, paralyzed by the stillness. Then, from the other side, came two short raps. My spirits jumped. Nigel had heard me, and I could hear him back. I wanted to knock all day. I probably would have, were it not for the fact that every hour or so, one of the boys pulled himself off the patio and came wandering down our hallway, gun in hand. I worried that if they caught us knocking, they'd move us even farther apart. Instead, I answered Nigel with one swift knock, and then both of us, being cautious for good reason, fell silent. We could communicate, sort of, but it didn't mean anything. Evening came. I lay in the inching darkness, trying to stave off panic. So far, our captors had not touched me. Aside from the first aid grope I'd gotten from Ali, I'd been left alone. Nonetheless, I was aware of being female every second of every hour. I knew what the Quran said about captive women. How they could be treated like wives. But I didn't know how literally that might be taken by the men holding us. The captives described in the Quran were mostly men taken prisoner on the battlefield during the 7th century, and war widows swept by force out of their villages conscripted to do housework. It seemed like ancient history, fallout from very old battles. But then again, it was how the leaders of our group described me and Nigel each time they shrugged and told us not to take our situation personally. We were just pawns in a religious war, an old story being replayed in the modern day. I passed the night alone in the giant room, sleepless. My mind galloped. I was desperate to talk with Nigel to have an actual exchange. During my ablutions before evening prayer, I'd studied the bathroom he and I shared. There was a toilet and dingy-looking plastic vanity mounted to the wall above a porcelain sink, framing a square of reflective foil paper instead of an actual mirror. There was a small window in the room, maybe 8 feet off the ground, covered by iron bars and with a wide ledge beneath. After breakfast the next morning, I wrote to Nigel again, flinging another ball of paper into his room to explain a new idea. I'd leave a note in the bathroom, tucked back out of sight on the window ledge, and then knock on the wall to signal that it was there. When he'd read it during his next bathroom trip and flushed it down the toilet, he'd come back to his room and knock to let me know he'd seen it. He could do the same for me. We did a test run. I left a note and then rapped on the wall. About 40 minutes later, Nigel knocked twice in return. It was a small triumph, but it mattered. We began to exchange letters, short, cheery-seeming messages and drawings, once or twice a day. We changed the hiding place from the window ledge to an empty light bulb socket in the vanity, which seemed a bit less likely to be discovered. I wrote notes to Nigel telling him to look for one beautiful thing, even something little, inside his room. I sketched a tiny picture of the two of us sitting on an airplane, clinking champagne glasses, hightailing it out of Africa in the comfort of first class. I drew a dialogue bubble over Nigel's head and wrote, "Shall we have another?" Nigel's notes to me were affectionate and funny and most often about the future. What we'd do, what we'd eat once we got out. He drew a picture of the two of us as smiling tourists pointing at giraffes at a national park in Nairobi. I memorized the contents of each note before tearing it into pieces and dropping it into the stained toilet, sloshed out of sight with water from a bucket. We knocked on the wall back and forth several times a day, like a heartbeat. "You there? I'm here." With our separation, all routine had gone out the window. It was as if our captors were running off a different set of batteries. Jamal no longer loitered in my room. Abdullah stopped overseeing my memorization of the Quran and was replaced by Hassam, who came in the early afternoons, first visiting Nigel and then me. Hassam was small for his age. Under other circumstances, I'd have thought of him as cute. His cheeks were smattered with acne. He had a wide, perfect smile and always seemed eager to engage. The other boys liked to pick him up and throw him over their shoulders for fun. "Okay, today is lesson," he would say to me. "Today is lesson how to be best Muslim." He spoke of Allah as the protector and prayer as a way of staying on a straight path to paradise. About our kidnapping, he was almost apologetic. "It is money, not Islam," he told me once. Where Abdullah had been erratic and controlling, Hassam was earnest and patient as I ran through the words of the Quran. He sang verses as if they were music, encouraging me to inflect my voice the same way, rising and dipping with each turn of phrase. Nigel and I had spent plenty of time discussing which of our captors we feared most. There was young Muhammad, who had hulking shoulders and eyes set close together like a rat's. Muhammad said very little to us. In the early days, he'd sometimes wag a finger at us and make a clucking sound as if to say, "You are bad people." Before we knew his name, Nigel and I referred to him as Son of Satan for the hatred we saw in his eyes. Topping our list was Abdullah, with his cold glare and mood swings and oft-repeated fantasy of becoming a suicide bomber and killing lots of people. Seeing more of Hassam and less of Abdullah might have felt like an improvement, a comfort even, were I not experiencing the frisson of round-the-clock worry now that Nigel had been removed from the room. I hated everything about being alone. There were days when nobody spoke to me at all, when Jamal delivered the food without saying a thing, when Hassam didn't bother to stop in. The isolation put me into a cistern, dank and deep. I started to understand the old movie trope, the self-fulfilling prophecy where a perfectly intact person is locked up and isolated in an insane asylum and begins, over time, to actually go mad. My own brain pawed at me. If I shouted, would anybody respond? If I died, would it matter? Everything I'd told Nigel, every chirrup about how this would end and we'd soon be sitting by a pool having sandwiches and a beer, now seemed like a farce. All the bricks of courage I'd stacked up over years of traveling were starting to come down. With the boys, too, something was slipping. Their civility was beginning to lapse. I was allowed to shower every day before the noon prayer, walking to the tiled area that sat beneath a window at the end of the hallway past the bathroom, separated from the rest of the house only by a thin cotton curtain printed with red hibiscus flowers. There was a shower head and a spindled knob, which, when cranked, sometimes produced a thin trickle of brown water, and sometimes nothing at all. Usually, I washed with a bucket of water delivered by one of the boys from the tap outside. I relished the shower, the coolness of the water, the slick sensation of having wet hair, and the milky scent of the German bar soap Donald had brought. Whereas earlier on I'd bathed cautiously in one limb at a time, now, driven by pure need, I stripped down and went for it. I craved those 5 minutes or so of private nakedness and the dribble of water, even rusty water, over my body. It was my one shot at something that felt remotely like joy. The curtain, however, was quite sheer. Both the boys and I seemed to discover this at the same time. With the late morning light pouring through the window, my silhouette was visible through the cloth. I could see through it in the other direction, catching shadows on the other side. Hassam was the first one I spotted, on his hands and knees, peering around the corner as if trying to see under the curtain. The next time I bathed, I heard a snigger and caught sight of two recognizable figures, Jamal and Abdullah, ghosting the boundaries of the shower. Too nervous to sleep much at night, I dozed on my mattress through the heat of the late afternoon, cycling in and out of wakefulness, my head throbbing with the constant ache of dehydration as I sweated through my clothes and the sheet on my bed. I woke up one day with a start when two boys with guns abruptly charged into the room, Abdullah and Mohammed looking wild-eyed and wound up. They shut the door behind them. "Mohammed, Abdullah," I said, sitting up on my mattress, my voice a thin tremolo. "Is there a problem?" I used my captors' names every chance I had. It was intentional, a way of reminding them that I saw them, of pegging them, of making them see me in return. I tried to milk something from even the shortest interactions. The traditional Arabic greeting is Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be upon you. I'd first heard it way back in Bangladesh and then through Pakistan, Afghanistan, Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. There was a more casual version of the greeting, a simple salam, and a more extended version, Assalamu alaikum rahmatullah wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy of Allah be upon you. I knew my Quran well enough by now to know that Allah had a rule that went with these things. I'd found it in one of my surah. When a courteous greeting is offered to you, meet it with a greeting still more courteous, or at least of equal courtesy. I'd tried it out with the boys and seen that it worked. A long greeting evoked a long greeting. I used it every time. I threw the extra words at whomever walked into my room, just to force him to linger in my presence, to address me as a human, for those extra 3 or 4 seconds that it took. Today, however, there was no greeting. Abdullah took a step toward me and pointed his gun at my chest. "Other side," he said curtly, indicating that I should turn face down on the mattress. My mind went into a free fall, dropping through one trapdoor only to find another one opening beneath it. Slowly, I flipped over, pressed my forehead to the fabric, kept my palms beside my face. The two boys were at my bedside, guns hovering by my head. I could see Abdullah's bare ankle, the color of dark coffee and hairless, maybe 6 inches away. Down, down, I fell. I heard them breathing. I closed my eyes, waiting for the next thing. Mohammed said, You are bad woman. Abdullah said, The problem is you. The steel finger of a gun barrel prodded the back of my neck. I tried not to think. The two of them were talking above me in Somali, as if they hadn't quite planned out their next step, as if debating what they could get away with. There was a pause. Then Muhammad kicked me in the ribs, hard. The pain ripped through my left side, causing an instant rush of tears. You are bad, he said again. We will kill you, inshallah. I saw their feet turn and walk away. The door opened and then clicked shut. The room went quiet. They were gone. I was still crying 20 minutes later, when Jamal stuck his head through the door. The sight of my tears seemed to make him sheepish. Before he could run away, though, I gave him the full Arabic greeting and then waited for him to say it back to me. Gathering my wits, I said, Jamal, please tell me what's going on, please. I watched some sort of unidentifiable emotion track over his face. He looked almost reluctant to speak. He sighed. Why? He said. You tell your mother no pay money. He shook his head as if he were helpless, as if I'd brought it all on myself. He turned to leave. We are here long time because she no pay, he said. The soldiers very mad. I could almost hear how this theory was put into place. I could imagine Ahmed's velvety voice delivering his take on things to Captain Skids. Skids would have repeated it to the boys, stirring in his own bile. For your frustration and misery, blame the girl. For 2 months of stasis and boredom and homesickness, blame the girl. For everything you don't have, for everything you haven't done, you can blame the girl. It is she who told her mother not to pay. Chapter 24. Maya. There was a little girl living in the house down the alleyway from my window, the daughter of the woman I'd seen hanging laundry on the clothesline in her yard. In the afternoons, during the hot, lazy hours when my captors snoozed in the shade on the veranda, I listened to the little girl playing as her mother washed cooking pots or hung more laundry. She squealed and sassed and occasionally pitched a fit, shrieking, Maya, the Somali word for no. I could lose a whole afternoon to her tiny voice. Sometimes I angled myself to look sideways through the grate toward them, catching glimpses of the mother's head or clothing, a snatch of yellow or deep indigo over the fence. Donald had given me a round compact mirror, small enough for me to fit through the window bars. When I held it just so, I could get a wider view of the neighboring yard, though I didn't do it often, for fear the mirror might flash and someone would spot my white hands sticking out. The outside world, the threat of being kidnapped away from my kidnappers and held by another group looking for Western dollars or killed for show, filled me with worry. The neighbor's little girl was too short for me to see, though judging from her voice, I guessed she was about 2 years old. She always seemed to be in motion, toddling the perimeter of the yard, bellowing, Maya, any time her mother tried to reel her in. Her mother was trying to teach her how to converse. Iska Warren? She would say to the girl. I knew from Jamal that this meant, How are you? When she was feeling agreeable, the girl would say it back. Iska Warren? Wafianhai. I am good. Wafianhai, repeated the girl. Wafianhai, I whispered along with them. Much of what they said I couldn't understand, but the tones I recognized. A mother and her child, a mixture of love and exasperation. Once in a while I heard a man's voice and what sounded like a grandmother back there in the yard. Sometimes I could hear a group of female voices, friends of the girl's mother, I guessed, trilling and laughing. The sound made me weak with jealousy. Everybody seemed to dote endlessly on the child. In my mind, I could picture them all. I imagined them warm and open, as people who wouldn't betray me. In my mind, I was going to follow them right through the back door into their table for dinner. a phantom white lady appearing from nowhere saying, "How are you?" in perfect Somali. I listened for the child's name but never managed to catch it. I just thought of her as Maya. In the afternoons, it was Abdullah who most often seemed to have guard duty. He stalked the hallway outside our rooms. Sometimes he opened my door without warning. He would step inside and stare at me, saying nothing, clutching his gun, keeping his gaze on me for full minutes without moving. Or he'd come in and tear through my bags as if searching for something. During the first week after I was separated from Nigel, he did this once, then twice, and then a third time. He tossed my things on the floor with a precise sort of violence. He still covered his face in my presence, even as the rest of them had given up and walked around unmasked. I greeted Abdullah each time. I watched him move around my room. He was bigger than most of the other boys, with a thick torso and long arms. His eyes were dark and spaced widely on his face. He had a deep barking voice, muffled slightly by his scarf. I did what I could to force a conversation, trying to trigger his interest in speaking English. "I wonder what we will eat tonight for the meal," I said loudly and slowly. "I'm getting hungry. Are you hungry, Abdullah?" For the most part, he ignored me. All the noisy rummaging through my belongings, I would later realize, was a testing of the waters. Abdullah was figuring out how much of a disturbance he could make while the other boys slept through, while Nigel stayed quiet on the other side of the wall. He was calculating just what he could do in those empty hours. With nothing else to distract me, I immersed myself in the reading materials Donald had given us weeks earlier. The moldy, antiquated booklets that had previously caused us to howl with laughter. There was the Times of London student reader from the early 1980s, filled with reprinted articles about the House of Lords and a tanking British economy, followed by lists of study questions and writing exercises with blank spaces to do the work. There was an English language storybook about twin Muslim boys learning to be kind. And there was the college catalog meant to entice rich Malaysians to study in the UK, its pages rank-smelling and glopped together by moisture. Nigel and I had flipped through the books with disdain. We'd torn out some of the cleaner pages and used them as plates for our tuna and onion. We'd mocked Donald for the proud way he delivered the books, having paid money for them, for thinking them relevant. We'd mocked the whole country of Somalia for sucking up what would have been trash and selling it in the marketplace. I remembered laughing with Nigel with the same distant fondness I felt when recalling eating a spinach salad or a piece of cake at home in Canada. I now sat on my mattress with those books and read every word on every page. I studied a washed-out editorial cartoon showing Margaret Thatcher dressed in a neat suit and pillbox hat. As the tin roof over my head moaned and expanded under the afternoon sun, I dutifully answered the reading comprehension questions at the end of each reprinted article in the student reader. Was this article written from a point of view that is objective or subjective? Please provide supporting evidence. When it came to the college catalog, I now saw the allure. The book listed universities in London, Manchester, Oxford, Wales, and many places I'd never heard of. Who knew England was so big? The text wasn't terribly interesting, notes on class size and curriculum, but the photos were in color, stained and faded, though still vivid. The buildings were stony and grand. I looked at the grass and flowers, at the students smiling on the pathways, backpacks hooked over their shoulders, talking about what I imagined were abstract and absorbing things. Those students were now over 10 years out of university, I figured. They lived in houses and had jobs, dogs, babies. I wondered, why hadn't I wanted that for myself? Why had I funneled my savings into plane tickets and not tuition? For fun, I pictured myself in a lecture hall, a dorm room, a cellar pub late on a Thursday night. It seemed to fit. It felt like a plan. I put myself on a quadrangle with brushed hair and a new laptop. The door to my room opened and closed. I looked up from the catalog to see Abdullah. He wore a purplish sarong and a singlet that was stretched out and yellowed with sweat. His eyes glowered from the open slit of his face scarf. This time he didn't pretend to search my room. Instead, he leaned his gun against the wall. "Get up," he said. When I didn't move, he said it again. It didn't matter that I'd worried about this, that I'd had a sense it might be coming. It changed nothing. There was no preparing. I slid the book from my lap and slowly got to my feet, feeling my body quake, my throat contracting. "Please," I said, "don't." Abdullah responded by clamping his right hand onto my neck, shoving me back until I was pressed against the wall. The heel of his hand jammed into my windpipe, lifting my chin. I started to cry while his long fingers climbed my face, covering my mouth, digging into my eye sockets. I felt myself suffocating. "Please don't, please don't," I said into the taut skin of his palm, gasping for air. "Shut up, shut up," he was saying back, tightening his hold on my neck. His sarong was now off. Beneath it, he wore a pair of gym shorts with an elastic waistband, and with his free hand, he was touching himself inside the shorts. My mind felt liquid, spilling out of me, unable to hold a thought. I felt him reaching down for the hem of my Somali dress, tugging it upward. I kept talking, my voice muffled, my arms batting uselessly at him. "Don't do this, please don't." He slammed a fist into the side of my head, and I felt my whole body go rigid. "Shut up, I will kill you," he said. "Shut up, I will kill you." Then he pushed himself into me and I wanted to die. In 10 seconds it was over. 10 impossibly long seconds. Enough time for the earth to rumble and split, making a gulch between me and the person I'd been. When he released me, I fell to the floor, collapsing like a rag doll. Abdullah rewrapped his sarong and picked up his gun. He opened the door and checked the hallway. I kept my head in my hands and didn't look. I asked to go to the bathroom. I was desperate to wash, to cry, to hide myself away. He checked the hallway again. "Go," he said. Before I could leave, he pointed his gun at my chest, close enough so that he was almost touching me again. "If you speak of this, I will kill you," he said. And I felt sure he would. Chapter 25, Catch 22. Nothing had changed, and so had everything. The seafoam green paint on the walls was the same, the windows with their shutters and grates, the dirt coating the floor, the roof overhead. The hockey puck can of tuna that Jamal brought at dinner time was the same. The call for prayer from the mosque near our house was the same, and the Quranic drone that drifted down the hallway from the boys outside was the same. What was different was me. I lay on my mat and hardly moved. I kept my eyes closed, one arm covering my face. My back ached. Between my legs, I was raw and sore. I felt as if I'd been evicted from my body, like I no longer fit in my own skin. What had been outside of me was now in, like some vicious flattening force. I was a ghost wandering the ruins of a wrecked city. I should have hated Abdullah, but I hated myself more. My mind ticked through every mistake I'd ever made, every wrong thing about me. Why had I come to Somalia? What had I done? I'd spent 8 weeks telling myself that this was all temporary, but now the reality felt unshakable. It didn't help that every minute was basically the same as the last, every hour like the one just passed. Alone with myself, I had nothing. Every fear I'd ever had came back to me now. Darkness was scary, noises were scary. I felt like a child. Panic swept over me in waves, giant and forceful. To think even half rationally was an effort. When I tried to steady myself, all I wanted was to hasten the inevitable. I thought about the blue-flowered sheet I kept on my mattress, trying to figure out whether it was long enough to be twisted into a noose. I thought through the layout in the bathroom, wondering if there was anything sharp or blunt or high enough to launch myself onto or off of. Something to hammer me right out of the world. He couldn't kill me, I reasoned, if I got to myself first. I lay for 2 days like this, getting up only to use the toilet, mimic the motions of prayer, and drink water, unable to go through with trying to kill myself, but with no interest in living, either. On the third morning, not knowing what else to do, I left Nigel a frivolous note in the bathroom, saying nothing beyond a recognizable half-sunny hello. If I faked sunshine, maybe sunshine would come. I knocked on the wall to tell him the note was there. Then I lay back down on my mat. Waiting for him to retrieve it and send a knock back, I looked around the room with its grotty floor and straw-colored light threshing through the window grates and tried to force a single positive thought. Was there something? There had to be. It would come. The expectation sat. It shot out roots. It became my stand-in for a positive thought. Later that morning, I stood up and started to walk. I did one lap around the room and then another. The walking felt good. It gave me purpose. I walked calmly at a steady pace, looping in bare feet, holding the hem of my red dress with one hand to keep from tripping. In motion, I told myself things, the words resonating right down through my legs. I will get out of here. I will be okay. There was comfort in it. I repeated the words like a mantra and kept moving. For once, I was grateful the room I was being held in was so big. Now that I was walking, I couldn't think of any reason to stop. Hassan peeked in at one point as if expecting to guide me in learning a new surah. I'd left my Quran sitting on the windowsill and made no move toward it. Hassan looked perplexed but said nothing and left. I was certain that none of them knew what Abdullah had done. When the afternoon arrived, the hot, quiet hours I now feared, I was still walking, sweating like an Olympian. Jamal brought tea and a bottle of water. Muhammad opened the door a couple of times, scoffed at me, then disappeared again. Meanwhile, I was busy getting ready to be free. I'd wiped any uncertainty out of my plans and all the desperation and vague sideways bargaining that went along with it. No longer did I think, if I get out of here, I will be kinder, more patient, more generous. I was thinking instead, when I get out of here. When I got out, I would hug my father all the time. I'd take my mother to India since she'd always wanted to go. I'd eat better food, look into going to university, find a man who really loved me, do something that mattered. I imagined Somalia as a story I would tell my friends. Not a happy story, clearly, but a story with an ending. Walking circles in my room, I awarded myself a future. Hold on for it, I said. Hold on. Hold on. It was a few days before Abdullah came again, in the late afternoon, just like the last time. Pushing me to the wall, his hand gripping my neck, undoing whatever resolve I'd built. He came again several days later, and again on many other afternoons after that. Each time it felt like being robbed, like he was siphoning something vital out of me. Sometimes he'd just punch me and leave. 6-7 hours a day I walked, sometimes fast, sometimes slow. The bottoms of my feet grew thick. A dirty pathway took shape in my room, a trammeled-on oval, a miniature one-lane track. I took breaks for water and for the bathroom. I stopped at prayer times and sat on my mattress, no longer bothering to go through the motions. I reversed direction several times a day to take the pressure off the inside foot. To an observer, I might have looked like a pacing, half-mad zoo animal, but what I felt, what I believed, was that I was getting stronger. I will get out of here. I will be okay. I strapped the men's watch Donald had brought us weeks earlier onto my wrist. Suddenly, the time mattered. It allowed me to plan. I'd look at the watch and think, oh, it's 8 o'clock. I'll walk till noon, and then I'll knock on the door and have my shower. As I moved, I shed despair. My body became all ropes and cords and knots of hard muscle. Hassam stopped me from time to time to work on my memorizations of the Quran. I took solace in my circles. Anytime little Maya let out a defiant yell outside my window, I silently cheered her on. When Donald came for one of his visits, I begged him to let me spend time with Nigel. I asked why we'd been separated and then watched as he blinked placidly, explaining that unmarried men and women should not consort according to Islam. I knew that, of course. It was a familiar catch-22 for me. Now that I'd converted, I was supposed to agree with the rules, never mind that there were plenty of moderate Muslims in the world who were more likely to see things the way I saw them. My captors were fundamentalists. If I argued with their views, I was exposing myself as an infidel. I still didn't know why they'd allowed us to stay together for so long before imposing their rules. Donald spoke in a consoling voice. He gestured at the room. "This is a good place," he said. "It is better this way for everyone." I knew he didn't believe that. It was clear that Donald was generally appalled by the way we lived. Not just me and Nigel, but everyone in the house. He almost always remarked on the dirt and lack of furniture. When he came, presumably driving from his home in Mogadishu, where he had a wife who cooked for him, he often brought plates of fried fish or pots of stew for the boys. With me, he made a show of being accommodating. Each time, I asked for the same things: a chance to talk to my mother, a king-size bar of chocolate, more food of any kind. He always nodded as if taking it all in, then did nothing about it. "How are you?" he said every time, after we'd finished the Islamic greeting. "Not good," I'd say. "I need to go home." His answer since the very start had been the same: "I think it will be soon, inshallah." The word Islam comes from the Arabic language. It means to surrender or submit to God. I would time and again see what this looked like among my captors. We were, all of us, meant to wait without complaining and see what would come. On this day, I decided to take a risk. "It's not better that we're separated," I said. "One of the boys has been paying visits to my room." I was careful not to name a name, convinced that Abdullah would find a way to kill me if I made a direct accusation. "He does things that are haram." Donald understood what I was saying. Sitting on the floor in the middle of my room with one knee pulled up to his chest, he appeared uncomfortable but not taken aback. Feeling the sting of tears, I gave him an imploring look. The leaders of the group had always struck me as more sophisticated than the soldiers. Surely they would disapprove of Abdullah. I didn't know whether Donald would want to investigate or admonish the boys, or whether he'd make some sort of change to better protect me, like putting Nigel back in my room. "I am your Muslim sister," I continued. "You have to help me. Allah says the Muslims have to help one another. You wouldn't let what is happening to me happen to your daughter or your wife, right? Please make it stop. I need to go home and live with my family. It's too dangerous to be here with these soldiers." He cleared his throat a few times. He then lifted a finger and pointed at my Quran sitting open on the mattress, motioning for me to pass it to him. I handed it over and watched him shift into a cross-legged position, propping the book carefully on his lap. He flipped through the pages, skimming over the Arabic. "Ah," he said after a moment or two. He then looked for the corresponding verse in English. "Here." He turned the book so I could see where his finger had landed. Chapter 23, verses 1 through 6. I knew the passage. It was miserably familiar, one of several places in the Quran where female captives, those possessed by the right hand, seem to be referenced as the exception to the rigors of practicing good behavior and self-control. I got anxious every time I read them, and now the words hit like a cudgel. "Successful indeed are the believers, who are humble in their prayers, and who keep aloof from what is vain, and who are givers of poor rate, and who guard their private parts, except before their wives or those whom their right hands possess. For surely they are not blamable." You see, Donald said, what is happening is not obligatory, but it is permissible. He steepled his hands like a wise man, as if he just taught me something interesting. It is not forbidden. I understood that the boys in the house took the Quran's instructions as literal, but I'd figured the leaders, especially Donald, having lived in Europe, would leave some space for interpretation, viewing it through the lens of the centuries that had passed, similar to the way my pious Christian grandparents looked at the New Testament, which had its own provocative lines about slavery and the treatment of women, cherry-picking the good while disregarding the bad. Donald was having none of it, though. His verdict, not blamable. But, I said, giving it another try, I'm being hurt. What's happening is a problem. He passed me the Quran and stood up to leave. He then said to me what I'd been saying to myself, though coming from him, it felt like a slap. Inshallah, Sister Amina, you will be fine. No problem. November arrived. I kept track of the days obsessively, ticking off friends' birthdays I was missing, imagining the turn of seasons in Alberta. I was aware that Christmas was on the horizon. In my mind, I trusted that I'd be safely home by then. Every Friday, the boys in the house washed their clothes and took turns going to a mosque, another way of marking a week gone past. I walked myself to the point of fatigue daily, waiting and hoping for some sort of change. I replayed the last conversation, if it could be called a conversation, I'd had with my mother back in early September, telling her not to sell anything, not to pay. My mother. I could build her in my imagination, head to toe, from the dark shine of her hair to the worn brown cowboy boots she liked to wear. I could put her in the room with me, practically. The last time I'd seen her was over the holidays, nearly a year ago, just before I'd gone to Iraq. We'd stayed in together on New Year's Eve at her apartment in Canmore, watching movies, her on the couch, me lying on the floor, both of us long past any interest in crowded parties and drunken countdowns. My mother had recently turned 50. I was roughly the age she'd been when she'd gotten pregnant with me. She was now the age my grandmother had been back then. We were like clicks on a dial, young, middle, old. Every once in a while, one of the leaders came to the house and posed a question to me, a query flung over continents, evoking something both intimate and concrete and sent directly from home. What award did Dad win recently? Communities in Bloom for his gardening. Where does Oma keep her candy? In a pumpkin-shaped jar. My answers were proof that I was alive, that my freedom was still worth negotiating for. To me, the questions also felt like gifts, an invitation to conjure my grandmother's tidy house in Red Deer or the quivering dahlias in my father's backyard. They were a reminder that I'd had a life outside. In my mind, I talked and talked to my mother. I imagined thoughts strung between us, spider threads floating over the ocean. She was sending love, I knew it. I sent messages back. I love you, and I'm sorry, so truly sorry. And a reversal of my earlier plea, a thought I needed her to hear more than anything. Please get me out of here. Find a way to pay. Do everything, sell it all. It hurt to even think it, but there it was. Each time Abdullah came to the room, I had to talk myself out of dying. When I wasn't walking or resting on my mat, I often stood at the window on the far right, next to the wall where the light pooled on the ledge, making it easier to read the Quran or one of Donald's lame books. Sometimes, especially in the mornings, I could hear the sound of mortars ripping through the air and slamming into buildings not far from where we were. My guess was that we were being held in some satellite village on the outskirts of Mogadishu. It was impossible to know who was fighting whom, Al-Shabaab versus the Ethiopians, one militia versus another. All I knew was the sound. The fighting would flare and then, just as abruptly, it would stop. After that, the neighborhood would be quiet for hours, eerily so, as people hid themselves away in their homes, waiting for assurances that things had settled. I remembered Ajos, our fixer at the Shamo, and his continuously ringing cell phone. Friends and relatives with moment-to-moment updates about where the fighting was going on, which streets were safe and not safe, about who had died that morning and who had escaped. Some days I stood at the window, hoping perversely that a mortar would fall on our house, collapsing the roof, filling the place with smoke, sending all of us scampering in shock. I didn't care who it killed. They all deserved it, every one. If I survived, I thought, maybe it would give me a chance to run. One day, through the side window, I caught a glimpse of a man I thought might be a neighbor. He looked to be about my age. He was walking across the scraggly adjoining yard and toward a shed, talking with another man whose face I couldn't see. He looked like a good person. I read something in his loping gait, the way he kept a hand flopped amiably over his friend's shoulder. My loneliness must have been telegraphing across the ether, because almost as if I'd called out to him, the man turned abruptly and looked over to where I stood half hidden behind the window grill. We locked eyes, both of us started. Instantly, I ducked out of sight, my heart beating fast. I worried that if my captors realized I could be seen by neighbors, they'd start keeping the windows in my room shuttered. Then again, the man's look had ruffled my invisibility. I wondered if he'd find someone to tell about me and whether that would bring about any change. It didn't. More weeks passed with no change. I stopped looking out the side window altogether. Standing at the other window, the one overlooking the alley, I could read the Quran and feel the outside air leaking in through the grills. I delighted in the slightest shifts in air pressure, moments when the humidity rose towards bursting, when I could feel the traces of a gathering wind. I imagined that I could see the curve of the earth, the crescent line between me and my old life. Somewhere far away, a blade of cool air might form over the ocean and start to move in my direction, raking across the palm trees and over the desert. Changes in the weather didn't come often, but when they did, it could feel symbolic, a thing running from there to here. One afternoon, a light rain began to dapple the concrete wall across the alleyway. I stood at the window, listening to it drum on the roof, my elbows propped up on the window ledge. The sky darkened to a powdery gray. The wind gusted, rushing through trees I couldn't see, causing the rain to spray sideways on the wall. "God, it's beautiful," a voice said, clear as day, articulating my exact thought at the exact moment I had it. The voice wasn't mine, but it was a voice I knew. "Nige?" The voice said, "Trout?" For a shocked second, we were both silent. He was maybe 10 feet away from me at the window in his room, standing at the sill. Due to the narrowness of the alleyway and the fact that the tin roof of our house overlapped slightly with the roof of the house behind it, the acoustics were perfect. Our voices carried clearly, sheltered by the rooftops bouncing off the high wall on the opposite side. When I stood at my window and he stood at his, I could hear him and he could hear me. A little miracle of physics. We'd gone weeks without figuring this out, but now we had. Chapter 26. A Feast is a Feast. What I thought about the future was this. Nigel and I would always be close. Our romantic relationship was over, but it had been replaced by something different. We were friends, true friends, best friends, embedded permanently in each other's lives. How else could it be? Not one other soul we would encounter on earth, as long as either of us lived, would know what it was to listen to the boys chanting Arabic out on that patio, or to have our lives regulated by their disinterested finger snaps. I thought we'd need to remember and discuss these things when we got out. We would build two side-by-side existences and have an abiding, everyday love. We'd sit on each other's porches for years to come. At our respective windows, we managed to talk for hours on end, coming and going from our sills, keeping our voices low and our Qurans open in case anyone walked in. I was terrified of being caught, but we were familiar with the routine of our captors, most of all their staggering laziness when it came to getting themselves off the porch. There were long stretches of each day when we were sure nobody would wander back to our part of the house. My window sat at about shoulder height off the floor, and in order to best hear and be heard by Nigel, I had to lean forward, standing on the balls of my feet with my neck craned toward the window grate. I'd stay there until my feet ached. When it was time to take a break, I'd say things like, "Okay, talk to you later," or, "I'm going to eat my food now," like an office worker about to wander back to her desk. Often, at the end, I'd also say, "I love you, Nige." He'd say, "Keep your chin up, Trout," and, "Love you too." If, before our separation, Nigel and I had taken each other for granted, if we'd been irked and touchy, we now knew enough to be thankful for each other. I hung on to the sound of his voice like a rope. We ran through old stories, adding new details every time. We played word games and told every tired joke we could think of. We discussed our nighttime dreams, our interactions with the boys, our bowel movements. Nigel liked to think about beautiful women to pass the time. Cate Blanchett was his girl. We made guesses about what was happening with ransom negotiations. We guessed out loud that together our families might manage to come up with $500,000 in ransom money for our captors, an amount that surely they'd have to accept. We talked about the future as if it were arriving at any minute. Nigel said he wanted to jump back into his photography and that maybe he'd even get himself to Afghanistan. I was fixated on spending time in Canada. When we said these things out loud to each other, they seemed like promises, sure to happen. Images of home floated continuously through my mind. I hardly knew my brothers anymore. My grandparents were getting old. I had friends I wanted to visit. I daydreamed about cold air and the beauty of a snowy winter. I pictured myself moving to Vancouver, which to me was the most beautiful city on earth. On my walks around my room, I blotted out my surroundings and imagined myself pacing the pathways of Stanley Park, moving through groves of tall cedar and along the curving seawall next to the bay. Something happens when you're alone most of the time, when there are no distractions. Your mind grows more powerful, muscular even. It takes over and starts to carry you. In the month or so after Nigel and I were separated, I could feel a new sort of energy making itself known to me. It felt physical, and also not physical. I could hold my hand several inches over my leg and feel the internal heat. The energy in my hands felt odd, but it felt like power, like a tool I could use if I learned what to do with it. I couldn't tell whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, or even a thing at all, whether it was a survival tool or the first flutter of lunacy. One morning I ate a tin of tuna and then sat for an hour holding the spoon in front of me, trying to see if I could bend it with my mind. I couldn't, not even a little, but still the idea seemed less crazy, more possible than it once had. Later, at the window, when I told Nigel about my attempt at a carnival stunt, he confessed that he too was experimenting with his psychic energy, trying to transmit urgent messages about ransom payments to his parents at home. "Who," Nigel asked me one day, "do you hate most?" We posed questions of one sort or another all the time. They were the springboard into many of our talks at the window. Conversation for us shot cleanly in two directions, backward and forward. We spent our time sunk in either memory or anticipation. "What's the best country you've ever visited? What's the best sex you've ever had? What's the first meal you're going to eat when we get out of here? Which are you most excited about, taking a hot shower or sleeping in fresh, cool sheets?" Now he was asking about the present moment, about our captors. The answer was easy. It was Abdullah I hated most. I hated everything about him, from his hairless armpits to the foulness of his breath. I hated his cruelty and his violence. I hated facing every afternoon, not knowing whether he was coming to hurt me or not. He came 3 out of every 5 days, more or less, and when he didn't show up in my room, I lost those hours awash in adrenaline, worrying that he would. When he did, slipping through the door while the rest of the house napped, I had active fantasies about wrestling the gun out of his hands and shooting him in the head with it, waking every damn soul in the neighborhood to the horror of what he'd been doing. I wanted to kill him. I wanted him to die. Those thoughts got me through moments, but not hours. And what I needed was to get through hours, lots of them. My hatred was there, simmering like a lava pit beneath the high wire act of each day. I saw it, but I didn't want to swim in it. I knew I wouldn't last if I did. I would far prefer to talk about meals and sex and plans. "I don't think I can play this game," I said to Nigel. "Let's not do it." For everything we'd discussed, I hadn't told him about Abdullah. I didn't want to poison him with it. There was nothing he could do, though I did wonder if he heard noises through the wall. His relationship to the boys was different from mine, anyway. For exercise, Nigel had taken to doing yoga in his room. He'd told me that Hassam and Abdullah walked in one day to find him moving through poses, and they'd actually joined in, earnestly trying to mimic his movements. They'd come back a few times after that, asking for instructions as they attempted new things, laughing as they winged their bony legs into tree pose beneath their man skirts. I took it as a sign that they were bored beyond belief, a sign that my side of the wall would never feel like his side of the wall. As the weeks passed, I wished for things that were large and abstract, freedom, comfort, safety. Beyond that, my most specific longings involved food, plates of medium-rare steak, bags of candy, a cold beer, and a frosted mug. I could pass 2 hours imagining one meal in granular detail, the ecstasy of making an omelet, for example, the chopping of a crisp green pepper, the sss of butter melting in a pan, the lemony yellow of eggs beaten in a bowl. More than anything, I craved a hug, the chance to fall into the arms of someone, anyone who cared about me. It never occurred to me to yearn for something more direct from home. But midway through November, Donald Trump walked into the room, carrying a big, sturdy-looking yellow plastic bag along with a smaller black bag. "A package has come from Canada," he said. Slowly, Donald unloaded the contents onto the linoleum square on my floor. He took out a few packets of pills, each one bearing a typed label and instructions. There were a few pencils and pens, a composition notebook, a pair of fingernail clippers, some St. Ives body lotion, a cellophane-wrapped packet containing 5 pairs of cotton underwear, hair elastics, dental floss, several packages of sanitary pads, a plastic box of wet ones, and a package of British digestive cookies. He then passed over a small black case containing a pair of clunky-looking prescription eyeglasses and, oh, how my heart leaped, a few books. "You're lucky," Donald said before leaving the room. After he'd left, I sat looking in disbelief at each item, the tears starting to well. I was almost afraid to touch anything. I'd been sent a book of crossword puzzles, a Somali phrase book, and Nelson Mandela's autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, Volumes 1 and 2, some 900 pages in all. I could hear Donald out in the hallway knocking on Nigel's door. I hoped it meant that Nigel was reaping a similar harvest. A while later, we convened at our windows, both of us giddy. Nigel, too, had been given medicine, toiletries, and writing materials. He also had a recent issue of Newsweek, some Sudoku, 2 books by Ernest Hemingway, The Snows of Kilimanjaro and The Green Hills of Africa, and Khalid Hosseini's second novel about Afghanistan, 1,000 Splendid Sons. Like me, he'd received a 5-pack of cotton underwear, but someone, was it Adam, was it Donald, had cut it open and apparently pinched a pair for himself. We would later learn that our captors had thoroughly picked over the contents of the care packages, removing a number of medical supplies and also some personal letters written by our families. I read the first volume of Mandela's biography in less than 3 days and launched right into the second, which covered the 27 years he spent imprisoned in South Africa. I seized on the story, reading it like a message directed specifically at me. Mandela wrote that he and his fellow prisoners taped notes for one another beneath the rims of their shared toilet. His mind played tricks on him. He doubted his own sanity sometimes. "Strong convictions are the secret of surviving deprivation," he wrote. "Your spirit can be full even when your stomach is empty."